it's on the next one.
May it please the court, my name is Justin Main, and I represent the appellant in this matter, Loudoun County. It is the county's contention that the rules of statutory construction and interpretation, other provisions within the Workers' Compensation Act, and this court's own precedent dictate that when an injured worker is faced with a pending joint replacement, their degree of permanent partial disability benefits be determined after the surgery and a period of recovery. To be clear, Mr. Richardson should absolutely receive and is entitled to receive compensation for permanent partial disability. But the issue is whether we determine that level of impairment after he's exhausted all of his medical treatment, including a hip replacement, and he's to that point where he's optimally improved, or do we determine the permanent partial disability based on the condition of his leg before the surgical procedure to replace his hip. In 1954, this court in the Walsh case noted that the Act was silent as to whether corrected or uncorrected vision should be used to determine the level of permanent partial impairment. And it noted that the Act should be interpreted and applied in a practical and common sense manner. Today I'm asking this court to do what it did 60 years ago and apply the Act in a practical and common sense manner as it pertains to pre- and post-joint replacement levels of impairment.
Counsel, let me ask you this. It seems to be a concern by the commission that these surgeries are not surefire. You know, it's not a guarantee. So just because you had the surgery appears to be initially successful, it can deteriorate, you can have complications, et cetera. So what are we to make of that?
Well, Your Honor, I would say that whether it's a joint replacement or any other type of surgery, there's no guarantees. It's the employer's obligation to provide that medical treatment and to get the injured worker to a place where they're as good as they're going to get. And then whatever level of impairment remains at that point in time, that is the employer's responsibility to compensate them for that. Now, and this was a point I was going to make later, but I'll jump into it now because I think it answers your question. If we look to other provisions of the Workers' Compensation Act, namely 65.2-708, it's the change in condition statute. And there's a section within there that pertains to joint replacements and prosthetics. And it notes that it permits review of an award 24 months from the day that the claimant undergoes any surgical procedure to repair or replace a prosthesis. Now, that section, I believe, is primarily aimed at joint replacements. And it addresses one of the concerns that the full commission raises and that Your Honor is mentioning today. And that is that in Mr. Richardson's a relatively young man. In 10 to 15 years from now, or 20 years, he will very likely need another hip replacement in his lifetime. Loudoun County is going to cover that hip replacement because he has a lifetime medical award. So under 65.2-603, he's going to get that second hip.
So 708, he gets his permanent partial if that second hip replacement doesn't work out later.
And so that's a good point, Your Honor. If after the second hip replacement, let's say it goes south and he has a 50% impairment or a 60% impairment after a second hip replacement. Under the Court of Appeals reading of the statute, we will have already paid 74%. He's not going to get another penny. So what 708 does is it adds a level of protection for individuals that have a second, third joint replacement. If their degree of impairment increases, the employer is responsible for that increase. For any non-prosthetic surgery that happens 5 years down the road, 10 years down the road, or further, the statute of limitations is going to bar their claim for any additional impairment benefits, permanent partial impairment benefits.
From your perspective, how does it work if there's a permanent partial disability rating given and the man is not yet at maximum medical improvement? He later gets to maximal medical improvement, and it's clear that the PPD is now grossly exaggerated because the later surgery was successful. Does the change in condition statute allow the employer to drop the PPD down in light of the successful surgery?
No, it does not, Your Honor.
So it's a one-way ratchet for you guys.
Yeah, so I think just to kind of get back to 708, what you're talking about, I think if we read 708 and 503, section 65.2-503, the permanency statute, in conjunction, if we read it the way the Court of Appeals is doing it, then it makes 708 meaningless in probably most, if not all, instances, because without
your earlier number, your PPD is always going to be higher.
Yeah, and I just based on my experience with joint replacements, not my own, but you're typically going to have your highest rating probably before your first joint replacement, because the doctor wants to wait and wait to have that surgery as long as possible. The second one, it might be deteriorating. You'll have that done sooner rather than later. So you're going to have these extremely high permanent partial disability ratings before your first joint replacement, and then it makes 708 essentially meaningless.
Well, except for 708 could be used if you had a disaster and there was a negligent operation and it made you worse than what you were before the day of the surgery.
Yes, it would cover that. And, Your Honor, another section of the Workers' Compensation Act, and I regret not briefing this, but it's 65.2-505. It's the apportionment statute in Virginia, and it allows for, essentially, if there's a second injury to the same body part, whether it's the current employer or another employer, they would get a credit for the permanency disability awarded in the first injury. So Mr. Richardson's case, if he was still working and he had a second injury with, let's say, a different employer, and his leg is amputated, his left leg is amputated, clearly that's 100%. But Loudoun County will have paid 74%. So he's essentially would be entitled to get 24% under my reading of 65.2-505. And that doesn't really seem to jive with the purpose of the Workers' Compensation Act, which would be his actual level of impairment, and I don't think there's any dispute about this, his actual level of impairment was 11% after Loudoun County's paid for that first hip replacement. So if he loses his leg for the second injury for a second employer, the second employer should be compensating him for 89%, not 24%. So I would ask Your Honors to take a look at 65.2-5.
That doesn't seem to be very persuasive to me. I mean,
well, it's
you can only get one payment for a leg. I mean, if you've already gotten 74% of it paid, then why would you get any more than that?
I only make that point to say that, you know, the goal of the Workers' Compensation Act in that instance is to put the burden on, I mean, it should be apportioned between the two employers accurately and appropriately, and I think that just, it muddies the water in terms of who's paying for the actual degree of loss.
You talk about joint replacement surgery, but is the same thing true of any other prosthesis this a person gets, that you measure impairment after the prosthesis has been applied to the person?
Well, you could certainly have a leg prosthesis where you actually lose, let's say you have a below the knee amputation and you have a prosthesis. If later you have
do you measure the impairment with the prosthesis on? I mean,
no, Your Honor. So that's a good point. That would be an external. I do not dispute that if you lose a leg or you lose an arm, you know, the entire arm, you get 100%. No question about that. You do not use the external device, this external prosthesis, in order to judge.
So is your distinction external as opposed to internal prosthesis?
Well, I think that's a distinction. I think the distinction, too, is also the actual rateable body part itself. So if you lose your leg, you lose the actual rateable body part, which is the leg. Mr. Richardson didn't lose his leg. He lost a component of his leg.
Well, and also, but the statute says loss of use is going to be treated the same as actual physical loss of a member. I mean,
yes.
It says that. I mean, that's what it says in 5, right?
Yeah, I think I think what the Court of Appeals misses, again, is that with the, you know, you have the hip joint, the knee joint, ankle joint, the leg is a complicated body part, as is the arm.
Right.
Mr. Richardson is just having, you know, the surgical procedure to fix one component of that. And I think, kind of going back to the point I made at the beginning about applying the Act in a practical and common sense manner, it makes no sense to have the employer pay for a surgery aimed at restoring and improving function and yet at the same time require them to pay for the functional deficits that exist prior to that surgery. I think that defies common sense to the point where you can get to a situation where a joint replacement is the equivalent of having your arm or your leg amputated. And I think that's an absurdity, and I don't say that to make an exaggeration.
Joint replacement is not what's like having your leg or arm amputated. It's the injury you had before the joint replacement that does that.
Correct, Your Honor. And I say that because there's a case pending in the Court of Appeals right now, Prasad, where he had a total shoulder replacement within 2 days of the accident. His arm was so badly injured that he couldn't use it at all. Clearly, he got up. Based on the Richardson decision from the Court of Appeals, he was awarded 100%. There's his loss of use is equivalent to him losing his entire arm, but he still has his arm. He still has his arm. He has a shoulder replacement and has recovered from that, but he still has his arm.
So he can recover 70% of his shoulder use and yet get 100% loss as if he didn't have an arm at all or a shoulder.
Exactly, and I think that's one of the absurdities with the Court of Appeals decision.
But you could put a peg on somebody's leg and they be able to use it a lot better than they did before you put the peg on their leg as well, too.
Perhaps.
But you still have to pay them for losing their leg.
Correct, Your Honor. I think there's a long way away from losing a leg and having a joint replacement. And I think that's one of the points that I'm trying to make. One of the other points is that this court in 1977 in the County of Spotsylvania versus Hart decision dealt with the issue of maximum medical improvement and said that you cannot determine maximum medical improvement, or you can't determine the level of impairment or maximum medical improvement if there's a pending joint replacement. And they refer to maximum medical improvement as that point in time where you're optimally improved. And I see there's no possible way Mr. Richardson could be optimally improved or be at maximum medical improvement the day before he undergoes a joint replacement. Those two concepts, I think, are logically inconsistent with one another. And that's not a factual issue. I have no dispute that Mr. Richardson had a 74% impairment the day
right.
before the surgery. It's the legal issue is, do we determine the level of impairment that day or after he's recovered? And, Your Honors, I'm going to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Counsel, I have a question for you. I'm
sure.
Sorry to go into your reserve
no, that's okay.
time, but your opposing counsel argues the legislative acquiescence rubric. That Roe was decided in 2002 by the Workers' Comp Commission. The legislature surely is aware of it and acquiesced for 17 years. You, in your reply brief, pages 1 and 2, seem to draw a distinction that legislative acquiescence, when it's the Virginia Supreme Court, yes, that rubric applies, but that we should not presume that the legislature is cognizant of or has acquiesced in a Workers' Comp Commission decision. Have I accurately stated your position?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Very accurately. I think, you know, the Court of Appeals and this Court can certainly look to what the full Commission has done and how they've interpreted statute, but the General Assembly, they're not paying attention to what happens with the Workers' Comp opinions. And this issue with respect to pre- and post-joint replacement ratings has never been decided. It was decided by the Court of Appeals. That was the first time it was ever decided.
Interestingly, the General Assembly did consider it. Roe was decided in April of 2002. On January 8th of 2003, Senator Normant, who at the time was the majority leader of the Senate, introduced Senate Bill 1130, and it, by its precise language, was intended to completely overrule Roe. I'm going to read the final sentence of the added language. It says, an award under this section shall only be awarded when the injury or illness has reached maximum medical improvement. Maximum medical improvement is reached when the anatomical effects of injury or illness are permanent and all reasonable and necessary medical interventions, including but not limited to the implantation of artificial devices, have occurred. By its language, it was intended to wipe out Roe. It was introduced on January the 8th, the first day of the General Assembly session. It was referred to the Commerce and Labor Commission, where Senator Normant was and is a senior member. On the day before crossover, the last day that legislation could be considered, Senator Normant asked to have it stricken. Stricken is legislative code for my bill's going to be defeated, so I'd rather have it dismissed myself. And it was stricken 15-0. Subsequently, the legislature has never again considered legislation to do that. Based upon that, I perhaps would accept your argument generally, but based upon that, I would say that in this particular case, the legislature looked directly at Roe and chose not to overrule it.
Your Honor, I must admit I was not aware of that piece of legislation being introduced. My response to that would be, the concept of maximum medical improvement, I mean, that's just what that bill does is it basically just regurgitates what has been the law in terms of maximum medical improvement since this court's decisions, you know, since the 50s and since the 1977 decision. So I think there was, you know, it's trying to codify what is already well established in the case law, and based on that, and I would just be presuming that it just wasn't necessary for that actual bill to be introduced because of the case law that was already in place made it unnecessary. And I think it's just, you know, this is just a matter where the court has not actually addressed this issue, this court or the Court of Appeals, until today. Thank you for your time, Your Honor.
May it please this honorable court. My name is James Swiger. I have the great privilege to represent Battalion Chief Michael Richards in this case. As Justice just pointed out, there is a rule of construction that deals with a law being entrusted to a state agency, to the Virginia Workers' Compensation Commission, allowing them to construe that. And when they do construe that, the General Assembly is deemed to have acquiesced in that construction when that construction has lasted for some 17 or 18 years.
That applies to the State Corporation Commission? That applies to any of the executive branch agency? Does that apply to the Workers' Compensation Commission? It's only been applied in Virginia to the Virginia Supreme Court.
There's case law that says that this court has acquiesced in the construction of the Virginia Workers' Compensation Commission.
What it means we look at this very authoritative body and we give it great deference and respect, but it does not change the nature of our review. Our nature of our review is de novo.
No question about that, Your Honor. I'm saying you give great deference to that. And the fact that the General Assembly has been aware of this construction of the statute for 17 years. And let me point out, Roe is not the only decision. If you look at the footnote in my brief, you'll see a number of decisions, many of which were mine. The Allen case, the Prasad case, those were my cases where we relied on that, and that the Commission has routinely ruled this. Now, let me also point out the maximum medical improvement argument the counsel made, the Hart versus Spotsylvania case. That case is inapposite to the facts of this case. What happened in Hart, was a deputy sheriff for Spotsylvania County and sustained a very serious wound in his arm due to a gunshot. He returned to full duty. He had planned to go to the medical record showed that he was going to return to his doctor, that the doctor was going to send him to another hand specialist who hoped to increase the dexterity in his finger movements so that he would be able to operate his firearm. Before that appointment occurred, Deputy Hart died of an unrelated heart attack. His beneficiaries sought an attorney and went to the doctor and said, did Deputy Hart reach max medical improvement before he died? They didn't answer that question in an affirmative, but said he had a 60% loss of use, and that went forward. The commission never made a factual finding as to maximum medical improvement. Clearly, they presumed there had been maximum medical improvement. When that case arrived in this court found that even if the commission had found that as a fact, that they were not bound by it because there was no credible evidence to support it, because the medical evidence showed that a Dr. McHugh was actually recommending an additional surgery. It, however, was not a prosthetic implant surgery. I think that changes the entire analysis in this case, because when you have a prosthesis, you are actually losing a part of your body. It is being removed, if you will, the analogy that I gave, which I understand is an extreme one, it doesn't apply as far as the degree, but if you were to have your leg amputated below the knee and receive a prosthetic device, they measure your loss of use without the use of the prosthetic device. Likewise, if you sustain a nerve injury to your leg, which is so severe that requires you to wear a brace on the outside of your leg full time, they don't measure the loss of use while you function with that brace. They look to the anatomic loss that you have sustained. In this case, Chief Richardson...
Basically, what God gave you.
Yes, sir.
Before the injury.
Yes, sir. That is exactly what...
As opposed to the medical profession helping you down the line.
Correctly. In fact, if you carry that to the extreme, Your Honor, as medical science advances, and certainly in the 39 years I've been practicing, in the various prostheses that I've seen that have been used, There could actually be a point in time where the prosthetic device functions almost as well as the God-given arm. And at that point, under Mr. Main's analysis, my client would get a very small loss of use, notwithstanding the fact that he's missing his God-given hand or arm.
Or leg, or whatever the case may be. He doesn't have his God-given hand or arm, but he has a hand or an arm. He doesn't actually have a permanent partial disability. Disability, as you point out, is a loss of use. It's not a loss of a piece of flesh. It's a loss of use. If you don't have a loss of use, why would the workers' compensation statute compensate you for a loss of use that you don't have factually? You had it before the surgery, but you don't have it after the surgery.
Your Honor, with all due respect, you have a loss of use of the anatomic body that you were given, and it's been replaced only by virtue of modern science. But nevertheless, the loss that you sustain to your body is to be compensated.
But that's not the way it reads. It's the loss of the use of the leg or the lower extremity. Not the kneecap, not the ligament.
I agree.
Not the toe.
Yes, sir.
So if you replace the toe and the foot works exactly the way the foot would work with the real toe, then thank God you gave us the medicine for new toes. But it doesn't mean you have a permanent partial disability because you have a fake toe.
I believe that is incorrect analysis, Your Honor. I believe that it is based on the God-given elements that you came into your employment with.
Where is that in the statute? I mean, I see the emotive nature of the argument. I just don't see any text. I can't think of a rationale why we would do that anyway.
Well, the rule of construction, Your Honor, is that the statute, the workers' comp statute, is highly remedial for the benefit of the injured worker. And if the statute is silent on that, and it's been construed in this fashion, then there's no reason to construe it in Your Honor's way, which would be to the benefit of the employer.
But this court's never resolved the question. If we took this to its logical conclusion, we wouldn't have de novo review at all at this level.
If you took it to its logical conclusion, if someone was paralyzed completely from the waist down but was given a body like Arnold Schwarzenegger was given, you would say he would have no loss of use.
I can guarantee you Arnold Schwarzenegger, after he became the Terminator, was not suffering from a permanent partial disability.
He was with respect to his natural body, and that's what I believe the statute addresses, Your Honor. The workers' compensation statute in its very nature is an abrogation of the common law. My client doesn't have the right to sue for pain and suffering. He doesn't have the right to sue for inconvenience.
He also has the right to get money for an injury for which there was not a remedy under common law because of the absence of negligence. It's not a one-way street at all.
It's not a one-way street, but the limitation of the damages that he can receive are very limited. And here, with regard to the permanent loss of use, this rule has been construed this way for 17 years, and it meets the beneficent ends of the act in compensating my client for the anatomic loss that he sustained to his body. And while he has, you say he has no loss to his leg, he indeed has a loss to his leg. He has the loss of a major joint component to his leg in that he no longer has the hip that God gave him or the socket, the acetabulum that God gave him.
But the problem I'm having, counsel, is it's not a loss of his hip. That's not the issue. It's a loss of the use of his lower extremity. And if God took away or fate took away or some other phenomenon took away the actual hip joint and man replaced it with a good one or a better one or an Arnold Schwarzenegger hip joint, then he hasn't lost use. He's lost something, but it hadn't been use.
He's lost the use of his leg, Your Honor. He has the loss. He has the use of a prosthetic leg. He does not have the loss of his leg. There's certainly nothing in the statute, and it is the bill that was previously introduced. In fact, they were even going to cure that issue by talking about the max medical improvement when you have a prosthesis implanted and changing that. In other words, the max medical improvement issue. But in this particular case, he has the loss of his leg. He has an artificial joint in his leg, but that's not his leg. And I believe the statute is there to compensate him for his loss of bodily parts.
He has a joint in his leg, but it's not his leg. That's what I think you just said. That makes no sense to me at all.
What I said was his leg is not its entirety. He didn't get 100% loss of use to his leg, Your Honor. He got a percentage of loss of use. That represents the major loss of the major joint, which is a component of the leg, i.e. his hip.
Well, that's
now
the question
is
now the percentage, right?
Pardon me, sir?
What percentage did he have loss of use after the surgery?
11%.
What percentage did he have before the surgery?
The 11% is not an 11%. That's the function that he has with the remainder of the leg that is his. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't take into consideration the fact that the upper part of his leg is not his leg. The determination by Dr. Avery before was that he had a 74% loss of his anatomic leg as a result of the injury that he sustained.
Fair enough. Thank you.
You certainly understand the issue, Your Honor. I appreciate that. Are there any other questions? I appreciate the court's time. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Yep.
Out of time. All right. Thank you all very much. Court is adjourned.
All rise.